The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
It's a windy Tuesday night in December. People stream into the gym at Nashua's Adult Learning Center. These 70 audience members are here for the second Cultural Connections concert in the city. And it's a small ensemble playing tonight. A violin, a cello, bass, trumpet, a percussionist. They're from Symphony New Hampshire, and executive Mark Thayer makes a little speech.
And it's been really fun to meet with people from all over the world and learn about their travels here and learn more about their culture and their music and learn a little bit of their music, which comes from far away, but now it's also part of Nashua. So we're calling this Songs of Nashua.
For the next hour, the group plays songs from Brazil, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Iran, and a classic Latin American lullaby, Los Pollitos Dicen. It's a song Gabby Diaz sang to her three kids when they were little. And at the concert, her whole family was singing along. Diaz is originally from Mexico, moved to Nashua 3 years ago with her husband and kids. Tonight, she says, she learned a little bit about different countries and people.
Porque conocí un poquito de cada país que interpretaron. Y pues sí, es muy agradable conocer personas de...
It's nice to meet other people, she says, because no matter where they're from, they all have the same goal. I ask her what that is.
Luchar, tener un mejor futuro para nuestras familias.
To build a better future, to be together and happy, to keep pushing forward. Nashua is the most diverse city in New Hampshire. Nearly a quarter of the city's population is non-white, and it also has the largest population of foreign-born residents.
So New Hampshire's always been, like, you know, especially the southern part of the state, has been a very heavy, like, immigrant, like, centric place.
This is something listener Manny Espithia has been wondering about. He moved from California to Nashua a few years ago.
It's like Manchester was built on, like, a French-Canadian and Greek, and like, yeah, especially in, like, Nashua, you also have some populations like Vietnamese at times. So, like, looking at immigrant waves and, like, what were the immigrant waves here, and, like, and kind of delving deep into that, because it's not like people just showed up one day. So I'd be fascinated to learn a little bit about that.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Daniela Ali. Today on the show, we're going to try to answer Manny's question for our Only in New Hampshire series. How do thousands of people, like Gabby Diaz, immigrants, decide on building a life in Nashua? How do individuals change when they immigrate? And how do those immigrants change a city? We're going to take a look at one city, Nashua, in just a few decades, 1965 through the present. There were other immigrants who came to Nashua before the 1960s, and before them, of course, this was the home of Native Americans, Abenaki and Wabanaki land.
The main reason immigrants come is to try to find, you know, better economic security for their families and more opportunities.
That, Lucy Sellier says, hasn't changed much in the last 200 plus years.
My name is Lucy Sellier. I'm a professor in the history department at the University of New Hampshire.
Lucy says recent immigrants came to Nashua for the same reasons past generations did, economics. From the mills to companies like Deering and Digital Equipment Corporation, Nashua's been an attractive place for more than a century. But there's another piece to all of this. People want a sense of familiarity, a sense of home.
So they might be people they know personally, family members or friends, or they might just be people who come from the same homeland, or at least even nearby their homeland, because they will find people that speak their language. They will find churches that are familiar. They can find food, you know, that is familiar to them, and find stores that where they can buy food that they want to have.
While the why of immigration has been more or less consistent, the who drastically changed.
Our immigration policy changed really significantly with the Immigration Act of 1965.
Before then, the U.S. had a quota system for immigration. There was a hard cap of 165,000 immigrants allowed in. Each nationality had a quota. So from Ireland, only a certain number of people could come, same for Italy or Greece. But after World War II, the Holocaust, and with the civil rights movement unfolding, U.S. politicians decided a nationality-based system might not look too great for the country. The 1965 Immigration Act did away with that quota system.
So we have two preferences under our new, 1965 Act, and that's for skilled immigrants, people who are professionals or have skills that will be useful in the U.S. economy. And the other major preference is for family reunification.
In 1960, New Hampshire was 99.6% white. The state was still very white 20 years later, 98.9% to be exact. Those demographics started to change slowly in the 1980s and 90s. A lot of the immigrants who came were highly educated and skilled because those were the kinds of jobs available in New Hampshire. People came from Cambodia, Vietnam, India, Latin America. Small communities started forming, and you see those pretty clearly in Nashua now. Bilingual churches like St. Aloysius of Gonzaga, the Mexican Bakery on West Pearl Street, Global Flavors, an Indian grocery store off Daniel Webster Highway. These are pockets of home for some, but outside of these spaces, it's America, a different place than Mexico, India, or Burundi. For as long as immigrants have come here, there's been a question of how they change America. What will it mean for American society? But also, what does it mean for the individual? Each person experiences these changes differently.
Okay, my name is Samba Halkos, and I am originally from Democratic Republic of Congo.
Samba's been in New Hampshire for 23 years. The day I interviewed her was the anniversary of her arrival, December 5th. A friend had put Samba's name in for a visa through the Diversity Immigrant Lottery, and she won.
Yes, imagine coming in December 1995. It was a big storm from New York. I landed in New York, JFK, and my friend came to pick me up, and we drove. I didn't even know where we are going. It was just snowing and snowing, and when we arrived at home, I didn't know the distance. I was just sleeping because I was very, very tired.
In Congo, she worked in an office, but she was still supporting her family paycheck to paycheck.
And now New Hampshire is like my second home compared to Congo.
Here, she's worked a variety of jobs, filing paperwork and in a factory. After going back to school for her bachelor's, she works as a counselor at the Adult Learning Center in Nashua, helping newcomers figure out how to sign up for a phone plan, pay bills, look for jobs, and learn English.
Usually I like to talk about my experience to let them know that everybody go through what they are going through. The first time, you are not home. Every time I told them, it's like you are taking a plant. You know the plants, when you're taking a plant from this place to the other place, you have to put a lot of water for that plant to grow. Sometimes the plant will die, and suddenly you'll see flourish again, come back and to life.
She, like many other immigrants, still kept strong roots in their country of origin. Every 3 years, Samba would go back to Congo to see her kids and the rest of her family. Her roots here have also grown, but integrating to America, to New Hampshire, she says, doesn't mean giving up her past or her Congolese culture.
For me, to be integrated in the system is to learn the system and to get that opportunity to understand the system and be comfortable with it.
But in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, getting comfortable was hard with such a small immigrant population. Samba couldn't find groceries she was used to or people locally that could do natural hair. And there were other concerns, too. Some of what we still hear about today. Racial profiling by police, housing discrimination, a lack of access to interpreters, and feeling that government wasn't accessible. So what kind of responsibility did the city of Nashua have in this process? How does a government respond when immigrants settle there? In Nashua, the response came in a form of a committee, a space for immigrants and people of color to address their concerns and questions. Caroline Mason moved to Nashua in 1972, and she was not an immigrant. She'd moved from Boston for her husband's new job. Caroline's son was going to Mount Pleasant Elementary, a school with a higher number of children of immigrants than other schools in the area, and many of those kids were Latino. Caroline's a teacher by training, so she was struck by the fact that few of the parents came to the parent-teacher events.
And suddenly we realized that, of course, because there was nothing going home in Spanish.
A few years later, Caroline joined the school board and pushed to get school materials translated into Spanish. In the mid-1980s, she worked as special assistant for Mayor Jim Donches.
He really clearly grasped the fact that we were really not serving, when I was a special assistant, that the city was not really meeting the needs of all of the residents.
So, in 1986, there was a meeting to talk things over in City Hall. Ann Ackerman was at this meeting. She was serving as Nashua's Ward 1 alderman at the time.
And out of that meeting, it was determined that if we're really going to do anything about change, we needed to have an ongoing committee, not just a one-time. So initially, it was called the Mayor's Ethnic Awareness Committee.
More than anything, there was a lack of awareness of anybody different from ourselves or from the people who were there, and sort of a sense that it was fine the way things were. Why was there any reason to do anything any differently?
In this group were folks from the school district, the police force, City Hall, the judiciary branch, spiritual leaders, and leaders from the Latino, African American, and Jewish communities. The people I've talked with who formed this group say this was the first kind of municipal government committee of its kind in the state. There were two big goals. One, improve services for immigrants and non-English speakers. Getting interpreters in hospitals, for example. Hiring bilingual folks to work in City Hall. And getting more people of color on the police force. The second goal of the Mayor's Ethnic Awareness Committee was bigger and harder to measure with data or changes to services. Make Nashua a more welcoming place for people to live. That requires buy-in and commitment from people whose families had been there for generations and from folks who recently immigrated here. Deepa Mangalat moved to New Hampshire from India in 1991. The country was going through a recession at the time.
So when we came here, it was quiet.
Deepa had recently married and had a one-month-old baby. She had wrapped up her master's degree back in India, and now, without her extended family nearby, she was focused on doing her best to be happy in this new, too quiet place. There was one Indian restaurant and one Indian store.
That was something. But I didn't go seeking people of my kind. I wanted to get to know, what this was all about.
The Indian community was small but growing. And in the early 90s, it mostly kept to itself. It wasn't until her two daughters started school that Deepa started to get more involved, as did other Indian parents. Part of her kids' education was going on long visits back to India. Many first-generation immigrant kids make these treks back to the home country to see extended family, to smell the air, taste the food, to refill the memory of this other home. And one trip back to India jump-started Deepa's thinking on what it meant to integrate as an immigrant in Nashua. After a week, one of her daughters said she wanted to go back home to New Hampshire.
See, for her, this was home, right? Nashua's home.
Deepa's dad asked his granddaughter, why is that?
Because I'm missing that, my home. So that kind of clicked, so this was home. This is not that is the place where I'm visiting. I'm visiting my parent home, right? Mm-hmm. This is my home.
Well, it's almost like, you know, at home you belong.
Yes.
To it, and you have
exactly
responsibilities and duties.
Exactly.
It's
exactly.
To belong to her new community, Deepa started volunteering at the soup kitchen and doing charity fundraisers for the New Hampshire Domestic Violence Coalition.
So what you do in the home, that you have to do for the larger community, because that concept, you know, if you want happy, that state of being, you know, you're happy and you're fulfilled, those around you also have to be in that state of mind, right, Daniela? Then it's a happy place. You know? So here you are, just you by yourself, and you don't know anybody else. You know, the rest of them are not doing okay. That cannot be. That no community is going to do well.
In other words, she couldn't just stay in her room anymore. And in a few years, she found herself a leader as chairperson of the Cultural Connections Committee, the current iteration of the Mayor's Ethnic Awareness Committee that started 33 years ago.
I had no idea that there were this many, that people from so many different nations lived in Nashua, Daniela. That was a shocker for me.
Through the last three decades, the committee has put on festivals to raise the visibility of the various ethnic groups who live in Nashua. But outside of these festivals and monthly committee meetings, the group doesn't have policy setting or political power. It can recommend potential solutions to problems people bring up, but it's mainly a sounding board, a way for various ethnic groups to connect with folks in government. Deepa helped put together last year's multicultural festival in September, where people make signature dishes, sell clothing or jewelry from their home country, or teach others dances specific to their culture.
And after the event was done, my mom got a little bit emotional because it was in that place, because the event took place in Ulster Middle School. That was the place where, you know, she dropped us off. Well, she dropped me off for me to start my journey, my academic journey. You know, that was Elm Street Middle School.
That's Paul Hanampa. He works as a community outreach coordinator at Catholic Charities. He's also the secretary for the Cultural Connections Committee.
You know, that was the first place that we came in. We had to get a translator. You know, guidance counselor, he knew Spanish pretty well. He helped us out. That's kind of where the beginning was. And then, you know, 12 years later, I was standing there helping planning an event, you know, being a professional. So it was kind of a full circle thing.
He moved to Nashua from Peru in 2005 with his brother to join his mom. Times were hard economically, and the Lima neighborhood Paul lived in experienced violence in those years.
My mom, her dream was for her two children to graduate college in the U.S. and become professionals. And she wanted the best future for us. And you know, her opinion was that the U.S. would give us those better opportunities.
He was 12 when he arrived in Nashua and started in eighth grade. Math was easy for him, but everything else, history and science, that was harder.
Well, I do remember one experience that I had. I was doing a regular worksheet. You have to fill in the blanks. And it took me so long. It took me like, you know, a good 6-7 hours. And I was doing this from when I got home all the way until around midnight. And then I come in the next day, I'm like, yes, I did it. You know, I'm very happy about my homework. And then I see one of my classmates just kind of banging the homework out. It takes him like a minute or two. And I was like, oh, wow. And then he got a better grade than I did.
Back then, the ESL program in Nashua was a lot smaller than it is today. So Paul couldn't rely on just that group of students to make friends.
As a teenager thing, you know, you kind of don't want to be isolated. You want to be just kind of fit in. And, you know, coming such a weird age, 13, 12, you know, just the start of puberty. So I had not only had to deal with the language, but how can I make friends, or how can I, you know, be part of different social circles at that age. So that was definitely my thought. You know, perhaps just learning English will be the fastest way to know to make friends.
Paul took his mom's dream to heart, even through those awkward transition phases or periods when money was tight. He took summer classes and paid his way through college. But through all of that,
I still consider myself more Peruvian just because a lot of my values originally come from there. And not that you cannot be, you know, Peruvian American or American Peruvian, but because I was born there, you know, I think that's always going to be home, I think.
A home that taught him the values he lives his life by now. Work really hard, and family always sticks together, including eating at least one meal a day together. His grandparents impressed these on him. His grandpa, who had moved from the countryside to the big city of Lima, owned a restaurant. He'd wake up at 4 a.m. and work till midnight.
And I remember when I was a kid, I would ask him, hey, could I have like 50 cents to buy like some kind of little toy? And from this, from a very early age, he would tell me, how's this toy? Are you able to eat this toy? Is it going to help you feed your family? And then I would be like, no. He was still giving the money at the end of the day, but he would always, you know, put that thought in my mind. You know, can I feed myself with this? How is this going to help me? And I've always kind of carried that, for example, you know, the value of hard work, the value of, you know, how is whatever you're doing, how is that helping you, helping your community, your family?
On his office desk, there are reminders of that. He has pictures of his grandparents, his mom, his neighborhood in Peru. He's now working with people and agencies who once helped him and his family adjust to life in Nashua. Paul has achieved the goal his mom had, for her sons to graduate from an American college, her whole reason for moving here. But he says, for him, things aren't finished.
I think that, you know, being an immigrant, you know, it's my job to just go as far as I can, you know, grab the baton and run as hard as I can and run as far as I can and then hand it off to the future generation.
He's planting those roots here deeply so that down the road, others, his kids, grandkids, his community, they can flourish. Thank you to Linda Long, Jim Donches, Father Dan St. Laurent, Allison Zaya, and Ken Johnson for helping me understand the start of the Ethnic Awareness Committee and about demographic changes in the state. If you have any questions about New Hampshire, its people, or its quirkiness, send us an email at wordofmouth@nhpr.org or leave us a message at 603-513-7796. More than 800 years ago, Magna Carta was sealed on a field in England. Its purpose was to appease some frustrated barons, and it was never intended to last. But somehow, this document created in 1215 is credited with establishing one of the most foundational principles of our democracy. So what does Magna Carta actually say? And how did it get from dubious stalling tactic in the 13th century to Supreme Court arguments in the modern era? In this episode of Civics 101, you'll learn how Magna Carta survived and thrived its way into our democracy as part of our Founding Documents series.
The High Middle Ages. Europe's population is growing rapidly. The Black Death is just a glint in some rat's eye and still a century away. The economy is booming. The Catholic Church is crusading. The feudal system is alive and well.
Oh, King, eh? Very nice. And how do you get that, eh? By exploiting the workers. By hanging on to outdated imperialist dogma, which perpetuates the economic and social differences in our society.
When are we exactly?
We're looking down the barrel of 1200.
Tremendous, tremendous. Carry on.
King Richard the Lionheart has just died after being shot in the shoulder, possibly by a vengeful boy child.
Man.
Richard's younger brother, John, inherits England. He is, by many accounts, a petty, cruel, and hated ruler. In fact, he attempted a rebellion back when Richard was alive and fighting in the Third Crusade. This is actually a key plot point in most Robin Hood movies, by the way,
Prince John is the villain who exploits the poor serfs and prompts Robin to steal from the rich and give to the poor.
Hannah, I love this. I love a good history lesson, but I just need to check in for a second here.
Uh-huh.
Don't get me wrong, this is a spectacular rabbit hole that we're falling into, but we do need to get a bit of a wiggle on this founding document series that we've been planning for a month or so.
I hear ya. But what if, Nicholas, I told you that there is a founding document all the way back here in the 13th century.
A founding document for the United States.
The very first founding document. The most foundational. And not just for us, not just for the United States. Some would say for the very notion of freedom under law.
That's got to be one heck of a piece of paper.
It is indeed. So shall we? Back to the Middle Ages, back to one of the pillars of freedom.
It seems pretty Civics 101.
Good, because this actually happens to be Civics 101.
The podcast refresher course on the basics of how our democracy works. I'm Nick Capodice.
And I'm Hannah McCarthy, and today we are kicking off our series on the founding documents of the United States with a charter. A charter written long, long ago by an unpopular king and a band of fed-up barons. Lords and ladies, may I present Magna Carta.
The Magna Carta.
Actually, no, just Magna Carta.
But that's what I said, the Magna Carta.
You have to forgive me. People in England don't say the Magna Carta. They say Magna Carta.
Who's that?
That's Derek Taylor.
I started out life as a historian. I read history and law at Oxford. I then got lured into journalism, and I became an international reporter working for Independent Television News of London, and I did quite a lot of work as well for ABC News in the States. I was a war reporter and reported from all over the world, especially actually in the US. But now in retirement, I've gone back to my first love, which is history.
Back in 2015, Derek did a deep dive into Magna Carta for the 800th anniversary of this document. He traced its influence all over the world and wrote a book called Magna Carta in 20 Places.
And what I did there was that I went all around not only the UK, but in France, in the Middle East, and indeed in the USA, to chart what actually happened in the extraordinary history of this amazing document.
Before we go any further with the extraordinary history of this amazing document, quick question, Nick. Do you know what Magna Carta is?
I've heard of Magna Carta before. I've heard it associated with Robin Hood. I know it's from England from a long time ago. But that's kind of it. I don't know what it actually says.
To be honest, neither did I. But it turns out that it is widely celebrated in the U.S. I mean, we've exhibited Magna Carta in Washington, D.C., directly across from our own Declaration and Constitution. We currently have a version of it on display at the Library of Congress. Magna Carta, which means Great Charter, by the way, in Latin, has been invoked throughout American history as a symbol of a kind of universal right.
I had no idea it was so important. But what does it actually say? It's got to have some powerful language, right?
Well, here's the catch. If you actually look at the language of the original document, for example, print it out and study it in school, take it at face value, you'll be hard-pressed to find the basis for democracy in Magna Carta's original words.
It's surrounded and always has been surrounded by incredible misunderstandings. It's believed, for instance, that it was the birth of modern democracy, that it was the first constitution, that it gave us equality under the law. All of these, I hate to break it to you, all of these are completely untrue.
So are we wrong to care about it? Hannah, did you conceive this entire episode just so you could rewatch Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves?
That was an added perk, also the cartoon version with the fox.
Oh, yeah.
I won't deny it. But absolutely not. That's not the reason we're doing this episode. Before we can understand how Magna Carta served our democracy, we have to look back at how it was supposed to serve a 13th century monarchy. So let's get back to the Middle Ages.
Magna Carta actually started out life in very, very simple terms as something which was simply a peace agreement. In 1215, King John of England was facing a rebellion by his barons, by the chief aristocrats in the country. And they decided, in fact, to try and work out a peace deal between themselves. To be absolutely honest, neither side really believed in it. They were both playing for time while they could build up their own forces and go back to the traditional way in which, in the Middle Ages, people settled their differences, which is that, of course, what they did was that they used the crossbow and the sword.
What Derek is saying is that Magna Carta was really just a stalling tactic. Remember, King John was not a popular man. Through a combination of high taxes, ill will, and failed military campaigns, the king found himself on the bad side of some of his barons.
So the barons say to him, strike a deal with us and we'll lay off.
Yeah, well, first they stormed London and gained a bunch of anti-king followers and really freaked John out. And then John asked them to meet him for a little chat. So they picked a neutral territory, a field just outside of London on the banks of the River Thames called Runnymede. And there, in the soft light of summer, they hammer out a peace agreement.
If we look at the wording of Magna Carta, it's full of words which have no meaning to us today whatsoever. Words like amercement, try things, halberdier. What on earth do they mean? They're old feudal terms. It talks about what should happen about fish traps on the River Medway.
I feel I should point out that there is nothing about a halberdier or amercements or fishing in the River Medway in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, as far as I know.
Right. Most of Magna Carta is about obscure, highly specific baron-type concerns, like serfs and castles and shires. But there is something recognizable in this document's 60-odd clauses.
We do every now and again stumble on one which we think, ah, now that's interesting, and for one moment our freedom-loving hearts leap. And then historians come in and say, yeah, well, you may think that, but it's actually really not quite like that at all. Can I just read to you what Clause 39 says? And you'll see, you think, well, that's great. It says, no free man shall be seized or imprisoned or stripped of his rights or possessions or outlawed or exiled or deprived of his standing in any other way. Nor will we, that's the king speaking, proceed with force against him or send others to do so, except by the lawful judgment of his equals or by the law of the land. Wonderful stuff, huh?
Yes, okay, now you've got me on board. This is wonderful stuff, and it sounds like trial by jury.
Clause 39 does sound like that, but it isn't that. Not really.
The first thing to say is that it begins, no free man shall be seized, etc., etc. Okay, so the first thing is that 50% of the population, women, are completely excluded. The second point is that no free man, actually, in 13th century England, only one man in five was free. The rest of them were agricultural serfs. They were slaves. So it didn't apply to them at all. So this is a document actually doing a big favor for a very small number of privileged men.
Derek's doing a pretty good job of turning me against Magna Carta, actually.
Magna Carta is not the mother of modern democracy, but some people do call it the midwife. Helped things along with some sage advice.
It's establishing the principle that arbitrary punishment is wrong. It's establishing the principle that this kind of thing that dictators do, in other words, that just simply say, take that man out and chop his head off, is wrong. There is a process, even though we don't agree with the process. So that establishes that principle. But the second thing is even more important. This is the king. And this is a real shocker for the 13th century. This is the king agreeing to obey the law. Now, that's a first. Until this point, kings were autonomous. They were not responsible to anyone except God, only to God. So the idea that the king has to follow rules, whatever those rules are, is an incredible breakthrough.
So up until this point, kings could do whatever they wanted. They made the law, and they were above the law. And then, suddenly, the law's above them?
Yes, just not this king.
Within 3 months of it being signed, both sides just forgot about it, and they went back to the sword and the crossbow. And King John even persuaded the Pope to annul it and to condemn it as being shameful. shameful that a man who was responsible to God should be made to obey rules set out by mere human beings.
So King John places his seal on Magna Carta when he's in this field surrounded by all of these really angry barons. But then he immediately runs to the Pope and he's like, I'm the king, so my power comes from God, right? And the Pope is like, yeah, absolutely. These barons can't tell you what to do. Magna Carta is null and void. And the barons wage war.
That's disappointing.
And it might have stayed that way. It might have been a document which got banned into the vaults of some dusty old library somewhere of interest only to a few historians. If it hadn't been for one thing, which is that within 16 months, King John was dead.
Dead of dysentery at age 49. Now John's son, Henry, is in charge. He's 9 years old.
He was actually described as being a pretty little knight, which is not the kind of words that you want to hear used about the person who's leading your side.
Luckily, the young king was appointed a grown-up person, a council, a knight named William Marshall who wanted to smooth things over with the barons.
He reissued Magna Carta. He negotiated a peace deal with the barons and said, look, the way it's going to be from now on under this young man, Henry III, John's son, aged only 9, is that we're going to follow the rules laid down in Magna Carta.
As it turned out, Magna Carta was a super useful negotiating tactic. King John wasn't so into it because it was about putting some checks on the king, at least for the barons' benefit. But for 2 centuries after King John's death, Magna Carta was trotted out and revised every time a king needed to suppress a rebellion or raise money for a war. It was a king showing good faith and protecting the interest of his barons. In turn, the barons would help out the king.
You said they revised Magna Carta, so that 1215 version wasn't the be-all, end-all version?
Right. There were actually many, many versions of Magna Carta. The most significant one happened under Edward III in 1354. Remember how Clause 39 sounded pretty good but wasn't quite there? Edward rewrote it to sound like this.
No man of whatever estate or condition he may be. What a step forward that is. No man of whatever estate or condition he may be. And if we accept for one moment that in the 14th century it was impossible for these people to imagine that women should be included, this is an incredible move towards equality. But something even more important. Whatever condition he may be, he shall not be punished except by, wait for it, due process of law.
So this is 1354. Our Bill of Rights is written in 1791, 400 years. How did due process get from King Edward to James Madison?
It basically laid kind of dormant for many centuries.
This is William Hubbard. He's a former president of the American Bar Association and a lawyer in Columbia, South Carolina.
And then again, in sort of a period of enlightenment, English jurists by the name of spell Coke, pronounced Cook, and Blackstone sort of dusted off Magna Carta at a time when there was a belief that the king had become too powerful and too insensitive to the people.
So Cook is this super important judge in the 1500s and 1600s in England. And there comes this point where the king is imprisoning people willy-nilly, kind of acting like the kings of old, and Cook and a handful of others say, hang on. We have come up against this before. We know how to stop the king from this tyrannical behavior.
They wrote about Magna Carta. They based their writings and their philosophies and their belief in human rights and freedom of individuals, used those words that, you know, though they were ancient words, they were still in existence and part of the law of England. And so they dusted off those words and used them in the context of the time to, again, try to restrict the power of the king. And soon thereafter, the British colonies were being established in the United States.
I'm beginning to see a bit of a right place at the right time thing with Magna Carta.
And wouldn't you know it, Sir Edward Coke was Attorney General of England when the Virginia Charter was drawn up in 1606. Now, this is one of many Virginia charters, but this particular one gave colonists land rights in Virginia. And
it gave people born in the colonies the same rights as people born in England.
And if Magna Carta applies in England?
Exactly. Then it applies in America, too.
It's where so much of what we believe is essential started. If you just want to go back and look at what is the foundation? The foundation for these principles are not something that just came out of the air in the late 1700s in the United States. They had been percolating and expanded, and there had been explications of what those words meant. And then you're simply applying those magic words, those critical words, to changes in circumstances. And there are times when circumstances demand that we go back to basics.
If you look back at the dawn of Magna Carta, back to Runnymede in the 1200s, the barons were ticked off because King John was, among other things, levying taxes that they considered to be unfair. He was doing what he darn well pleased, and they decided that enough was enough.
Okay, this little history lesson is beginning to make a lot more sense. Let's keep it in the episode.
Thank you.
Because now we're here, right? At the dawn of the United States, and a bunch of people who are supposedly British citizens are not being granted the same rights as British citizens.
The colonists were asserting that they had the same rights as Englishmen. As American colonists, they still had the same rights as Englishmen. And how did they prove that? They proved that by citing provisions of Magna Carta.
Now, at this point in England, Parliament is really more important than Magna Carta. Magna Carta is respected, and it's lodged in English common law, but you're not necessarily going to hear British-born citizens make constant reference to it in their laws. But for Americans, this old, unshakable document is essential to their case.
You know, the phrase taxation without representation became a rallying cry of the colonists, who, because of the rights conveyed in Magna Carta, believed that the British government had broken its contract, and Magna Carta gave them a basis for rebellion and gave intellectual underpinning to the revolution.
Magna Carta was actually at hand when colonists organized their first act of political rebellion.
That was the Stamp Act Congress of 1765.
That's Joel Collins, lawyer and law professor at South Carolina Honors College.
Here again, citing Magna Carta, they said this violates Clause 12, which guarantees the king will not enact taxes except with the common consent of the realm. So the idea of taxes without representation, they said, violates Magna Carta.
When the First Continental Congress met in fall of 1774 and drafted a Declaration of Rights and Grievances to be issued to Britain, guess what was on the seal of their journal?
I'm going to guess it has something to do with Magna Carta, Hannah.
It does indeed. The words Magna Carta at the base of a column grasped by 12 hands representing unity.
Wait, if it's the colonies, why is it 12 hands and not 13 hands?
That's a good question. In 1774, there were only 12 colonies. Delaware was still a part of Pennsylvania until 1776.
Delaware!
Delaware, man. And speaking of those original 12 colonies, concepts that originated in Magna Carta were in 9 of those 12 original state constitutions.
You know, that men have the right of self-determination, unalienable rights. They are rights that that you don't fight for and earn. They're yours upon your birth.
But by the time we get to the Declaration of Independence, you're not seeing Magna Carta explicitly referenced, right?
Yeah, true. But as Joel points out, our framers were reading a lot of philosophy and social theory, and they built that into the Declaration and eventually into the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They interpreted the principles of documents like Magna Carta for the purposes of American democracy.
I think they were very mindful of Magna Carta. I think they were extremely well read. Read the golden passages of Magna Carta, Clause 38. Henceforth, no bailiff shall upon his own unsupported accusation put any man to trial without producing credible witnesses to the truth of the accusation. There's your every man. He's being given rights. Clause 39, no free man shall be taken, imprisoned, deceased, outlawed, banished in any way, and we will proceed against or prosecute him only upon the lawful judgment of his peers. There's your jury trial. And the law of the land. There's your due process of law. applicable to everybody.
It kind of doesn't matter that Magna Carta was first written for a select group of people with totally different life experience and morals and prejudice than us. What matters is this fluke of a 1215 stalling tactic somehow stayed alive long enough to inspire an almost divine principle. And that's why it's important that we learn about it.
You know, Magna Carta has just had a tremendous explosive impact over time. Just again, it was kind of a seed, and that seed has really, you know, I think, developed some offshoots that really might have been very surprising to the barons.
This is Susan Herman, president of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Magna Carta idea of law of the land was not something that went throughout society. It only went to 15% of the people. Now, when the United States Constitution was written, I think, you know, we don't like to think about it this way, but the framers of our Constitution, our founding fathers, were not that dissimilar from the barons who went to King John in 1215. They were all white men who was left out of the people who were writing the Constitution and who was left out of the basic idea of, you know, who could vote and who was a member of the society were women. People of color, Native Americans, men without property.
In Magna Carta, Susan says, you see the seeds of freedom. It is by no means a freedom that applies to all, but the idea itself is so good and feels so right to all humans that it sticks and it evolves and it spreads.
So I went this morning, because I knew we were going to be talking, I went to the ACLU website and just searched the term Magna Carta, and there were 77 results. When ACLU lawyers write briefs, there are many kinds of briefs in which they reference Magna Carta and those essential principles of no one being above the law.
Modern-day lawyers are citing a document from 800 years ago?
Magna Carta has been referenced dozens of times in Supreme Court cases over the years.
The more one examines the history of the excessive fines clause and its antecedent, the excessive amercements clause of Magna Carta.
My concept of due process, Mr. Justice Black, which I think goes back to the law of the land, the Magna Carta.
There were no courts to which people could seek redress against the crown at the time of Magna Carta.
In fact, the issue was addressed in the very first clause of Magna Carta. There King John agreed, and this is a quote, the English church shall be free, end quote, and he accepted the church's, quote, freedom of elections, right thought to be.
So when we think of Magna Carta as the midwife of democracy, it's kind of like thinking of the original Constitution and the Bill of Rights as the things that guarantee our equality, because when they were written, they didn't actually guarantee equality and liberty for everybody. They became that the more that we use them, because the basic principles of freedom are in there.
Exactly. Susan says it boils down to fairness.
I think what due process means is it really means being fair. Law of the land, due process, it means that. Well, another way that I would describe it is, to me, a lot of the idea of rights and civil liberties is really about the golden rule. That imagine that you're being charged with something. Somebody says that you've done something that's a crime, that's wrong, and then they just want to lock you up and or punish you somehow. And you would feel that that was very unfair because you might have a defense. You might have something to say about how you don't think you really were wrong and what you were doing. And if you didn't get a chance to defend yourself, you would really feel that that was unfair.
Fairness is this thing that we're naturally drawn to. Remember how Derek Taylor talked about our freedom-loving hearts at the beginning of the episode? How we read things into Magna Carta that aren't literally there? That's because we sense this magic being at the core of Magna Carta. An accidentally, possibly made-up magic being that ended up being strong enough to inspire a great democratic experiment.
That nobody is above the law.
Not even Mother England.
It sounds like we might be ready for a declaration, Hannah. Maybe even the declaration.
That's next time on Civics 101. That's it for Word of Mouth this week.
This week's show was produced by me, Daniela Ali, along with Justine Paradise, Jimmy Gutierrez, Ben Henry, Nick Capodice, Hannah McCarthy, and Jackie Helpert. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Civics 101 is brought to you in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.